This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everyone. I trust you all had a good weekend and getting ready for the busy Christmas holiday season. Well, someone who knows a little bit about busy is Andrew Parsons. To say it's been a busy time for him would be an understatement. The MHA for Burgio Lapoil has been focused of late on addressing the damage caused by torrential rains that inundated the Port of Basque and Codroy Valley region nearly 2 weeks ago. That's on top of the responsibilities, of course, of his portfolio that encompasses industry, energy, and technology. And while they might sound like they're all somehow related, they're all very, very diverse, of course. So here with an update on the many issues on his desk is none other than Minister Andrew Parsons. Hello.
Good afternoon.
It has been busy, hasn't it?
Oh my God, it's absolutely been hectic. Besides the, the district things, which have been very difficult. When you look at the department, it's been busy, but it's certainly exciting. And there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts, but never a lack of excitement in terms of the things that we want to try to accomplish.
No, indeed. And I want to get into some of that now in a moment. But first to Burgio Lapoil and the rain. And despite that record-breaking rainfall, there's since been a number of heavy rainfalls in the region, not as bad as that. But so what's the latest now on efforts to fix all that?
Well, thankfully, it's been pretty quiet in terms of at least the messages and calls I've been getting ever since they reopened on Wednesday. So thankfully, it seems that traffic, freight, people are getting back and forth now. I know that they were actually doing some paving. The weather cooperated long enough for them to not only get the work done, some paving's been done. So that's been great. I mean, the reality is that I think we're getting back to some sense of normalcy. Things are where they need to be, but I can tell you it was an absolutely hectic, difficult, strenuous, stressful week for so many, well, just about everybody, really, in some capacity. And as we do time and time again, Newfoundlanders and Labradorians come together, and in this case, there were many different hands coming together, whether it be our local fire chiefs and mayors and town staff, right up to the Canadian Armed Forces was on the ground and in the air. Everybody came together and, we're very lucky. I mean, I look at what other places like BC have faced. I was envisioning, people being evacuated possibly. And thankfully, the biggest issue that we had to deal with was the roads being cut off.
And it seems to me that in the last, 10, 15 years in particular, we've had some of these major storms or major events, and it seems that the culverts get easily overwhelmed. And we've been talking about these 1-in-100-year storms and replacing the culverts to increase the capacity and that sort of thing. But it seems that we're slowly working across the province, replacing some of these culverts. Is that what the problem was, that the culverts just couldn't handle the flow?
I wouldn't be the best to describe. Sometimes I wonder if it's not, if this happened 15 years ago, you certainly did not have the social media impact, which is more people talking and commenting, which has its pros and cons. I've seen this before in my district, absolutely, in Burgio, on the Burgio Highway. That was, we went through, I think it was about 5 years ago, where a significant rainstorm, we had the road collapse in various places, and that was culvert related. In this case, I mean, I don't know how you keep up with that amount of rainfall. So it wouldn't be right for me to comment from an engineering standpoint as to, what happened there. I do know, or I've been told, that with the replacement culverts have been larger to handle these situations. Was there something else? I don't know. But when you have that amount of rainfall in that short a period of time, I think no matter where you are, you're probably going to have some damage caused.
And we were talking to the meteorologists ahead of time, and really it sounded so, so horrible. We couldn't imagine what we were going to be facing, and yet it, all things considered.
Oh, my God. It absolutely could have been worse. The numbers I was hearing prior to it commencing, one number that was tossed at me by the department was 400 millimeters, and I was, oh, my God, that's far more than they had in BC. I was absolutely fearful and worried. But again, the numbers we got were far less than that. Although one of the stats I did see from Environment Canada was that the November in the Port of Basque area, I guess the southwest coast. That was the rainiest month ever recorded. They've been keeping stats, I guess, back to 1909, and that was the rainiest. And again, not every day was raining. That was a case of a lot came in a small period of time, but it certainly was record-setting, no doubt.
So the transportation routes back up?
The roads are open. There's still some areas. There's in the community of Cape Ray, there were certain laneways and roadways that were cut off. I know the department has been in touch, and we've been working on that. I'm not sure, to be honest, about the status in Codroy Valley. I do know that some industrious citizens, along with some contractors, were able to make the roads passable. So no doubt there is work left to do, but I am not aware, besides Cape Ray, of any communities or people totally cut off right now. That's the latest that I have. Now, that could be different, but that's basically what I've been operating on.
In terms of coordination and getting the job done, what were some of the more challenging aspects of what happened?
Number one, I'll speak about the pluses, I guess, or the positives. The emergency team here in St. John's, which would have been people from Fire and Emergency Services, they had somebody from the Armed Forces, they had just a bunch of different people. They were in place well before the weather hit. They were prepared. They were coordinated. Meetings lined up with all the communities that possibly could be affected and their staff. Myself and MHA Scott Reed were notified, and our staff. So everybody were prepared. Like, we were in the know. They were letting us know what they could. And there were multiple other meetings that, were happening at the same time that I probably wasn't a part of. I think our biggest job, myself and Scott, was just trying to get the word out to our citizens, which is, again, one of the pluses of social media, is that I was able to interact with a lot of people via Facebook, just getting the word out, people sharing that. It was good. I think in times like this, people just want information. People just want to know what is going on, and they want it as quick as possible. So again, we had multiple meetings. The first couple of days, we were meeting 8 a.m., 11, 2, 5, 8 at night, 11 at night, 2 in the morning. Like, the meetings were going around the clock. Just getting the updates. And again, after the first couple of days, you saw, okay, the weather is settled. Now it's sort of, okay, what is the damage? How do we move from that? So the first couple of days were very trying for the communities, because we were just waiting from the communities to hear, okay, what's going on? Where are the issues? After that, it very much became a transportation and infrastructure system. One of the challenges at the same time was, especially later on, is that, just trying to deal with citizens. A lot of information going around, some of it not always accurate, and trying to combat that. So people would say, well, I'm hearing, such and such, this road is going to open. And I would go make sure I was right and get the latest information, have the report back to people and say, no, that's not necessarily the case. So that's a challenge at any time. But, again, it didn't lead to any serious, significant issues. People were absolutely cooperative. The vast, vast majority of people got it. They were very patient. They understood. They were helping their neighbors. So I guess, again, it certainly went a lot better. It could have went a lot worse than what it did.
Indeed. And I mean, Port of Basque, as you know, is the gateway to Newfoundland and Labrador. It's a vital link. And, of course, that was cut off for a brief period of time. Did that present any problems?
Absolutely. It's not a surprise to us. It is a surprise to a lot of people that, of the importance of Marine Atlantic to our province. It's, in terms of providing goods and just freight, you name it, coming across. And, again, there are other services. But when it comes to our produce and groceries, a lot of it comes in that way, or just, whether it's people coming in that way. So having that link cut off, I think, was a real eye-opener to people. And then in terms of opening up the other port, Argentia, which is not a constitutionally mandated service, but it's certainly important. But there's even challenges for Marine Atlantic there. So even I was, certainly surprised that when I was dealing with them, just the different challenges that they face. But, I had to give them kudos. Marine Atlantic showed up. They were a part of this. They were very helpful. And again, we're very understanding, trying to move. And I know, if anything, now they're trying to deal with the backload, the backlog of traffic that's piled up. But when Marine Atlantic's not traveling, the province notices. And in this case, it was nothing to do with Marine Atlantic themselves, but they came through in a big way.
And, of course, that triggers panic buying and all the rest. I know that some stores in Port of Basque had encountered a few shortages.
It happens every time. I mean, it's the same thing with COVID when people were stocking up on toilet paper. I mean, people panic buy, people hoard, even every time in here in the city when people talk about getting your storm chips and stuff. I think it's just human nature, and it is what it is. Thankfully, look, nobody starved. Nobody, you know, you might have done without a certain staple for a small period of time, but generally speaking, the stocks were, the shelves were restocked within a pretty reasonable period of time. So, yeah, it provided some inconvenience, but, I mean, you gotta, it's all about being relative here. I mean, we've seen others around the world go without so much more for so much longer. So in the grand scheme of things, I think we did all right. But again, people like Sean Lurish out our way in Central Dairies, Gene Coleman in Coleman's group, I mean, they were going above and beyond to get freight here, to get it on shelves. When you're seeing grocery runs by helicopter, that was pretty impressive.
And of course, we had this pivot by Marine Atlantic to move to Argentia and get things rolling there. And we saw the outpouring of people in the Placentia-Argentia area coming out and helping those very tired, very frustrated truckers, of course, who were stuck in, you know, doing these extra long shifts that they weren't expecting either. But it's led to some calls in the Placentia region to reinstate an extended service through Argentia. You made a very interesting point there previously, saying that, you know, Argentia is not constitutionally mandated. Can those two ports operate at the same time year-round?
Well, you know what? I certainly won't say anything negative about the port of Argentia, and they have shown their importance. So two things I would point out that are important. One is that it isn't a constitutionally mandated port. So that presents one issue there in terms of the federal obligation, which segues into the second point, is that in terms of, you know, we're already dealing with, as far as I'm concerned, an issue when it comes to the federal cost recovery for Marine Atlantic. We are paying too much. Marine Atlantic is not their fault. They need to recoup so much of the cost, and that's a figure that has come up with by the federal government, by the Department of Transport, an issue that I'm literally looking at right now on my desk. I have a letter that I'm prepared to send to the federal minister on this issue. In Argentia, it's 100% cost recovery. So what I would suggest is that Marine Atlantic would probably have no issue with doing that, but we are going to require some significant federal, I guess, conversations as to the cost side of that. It is not cheap. And so there's conversations to be had. So again, I'm not saying anything about the pro or the con. What I'm saying is that the service itself, Marine Atlantic, I think there's an argument there that we need to have a bigger conversation with the feds on what we are entitled to in this province via the terms of union.
We've been speaking with the Minister of Burgio Lapoil, Andrew Parsons. We're going to talk to the Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology, who happens to be Andrew Parsons, right after this.
The workday winds down with Greg Smith in The Drive. Get up to speed on the day's events and current traffic, weather and community updates each weekday afternoon on your VOCM.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
We're speaking with Andrew Parsons, and he was just talking about the situation in his district, but he has a very busy portfolio, as you all know, industry, energy, and technology. And last week there was a really big announcement on top of everything else that was happening concerning Come By Chance. So what does last week's announcement mean?
Yeah, we were extremely excited to finally announce the, I guess, the reopening of Come By Chance after, my God, it'll be 2 years this coming March since it was shut down due to the onset of the pandemic. So since that time, we've been doing this, you know, I guess, if I was to provide a timeline, so in March it shut down. That extended on. In January of 2021, we were finally able to announce basically a funding package where we helped to keep Come By Chance in warm idle, which meant that the asset stayed. It stayed warm, which meant it was better for, you know, trying to entice or find buyers for the you know, again, North Atlantic, which owns it, kept people working. If you had allowed that to shut down, it could have done serious damage to the facility as a whole, which then hurt the possibility of even selling it. During all this time, we've seen a huge change in the industry. We've seen refinery output around the world decline because of the whole situation as it relates to the oil industry. It's getting harder. There's just, you know, less need. And in many cases, they're shutting down refineries all around the place. to basically create super refineries. But again, it made it certainly challenging here to find someone who wanted to come in and to reopen the refinery. So if you go back to last year, we kept it open with a six-month funding agreement, which both sides of the deal lived up to the arrangement. The jobs were had, people working, the place was kept warm. Since that time, we know that the companies have been preparing for the reopening. They've invested themselves out of their own funding to employ people to prepare for the conversion in the hopes that it would happen. The biggest issue that we're dealing with, obviously, was the environmental indemnity that comes with it, which I can get to in a second. Long story short, we get here now where we have a deal. So Cresta, an American company, has bought 60% of the refinery. They retain North Atlantic as a minority partner. Instead of refining oil, they're going to create renewable diesel, biodiesel, which has markets primarily right now in California. But I think as things change, you're going to see more and more markets from that. And it will come from different feedstocks, including, whether it be canola. We talked about different kinds of oils that can be, like cooking oils even, that can be refined. It's something completely different, in fact, amongst the first of its kind in the nation happening right here. Part of that is you're going to see a minimum jobs of 200, but the hope is that as this thing expands, you're going to see that number start to go up. There was no funding package attached to this. There was no government funding in assistance. None of that was provided. What we've done with the environmental indemnity to make this happen is prior to the 2014 deal, which saw it reopen when North Atlantic bought it, or I guess not reopen, but sort of find new ownership, government of the day provided an environmental indemnity for the possible pollution up to that point. Now, that number was never totally quantified or calculated. It ranged between $34 million possibly up to as high as just under $270 million. Government agreed to retain that for the period 2014 to 2024, a 10-year indemnity. That was part of trying to get them there. Now we're in 2021, so what we've agreed to do is take the indemnity and go from 2021 to 2031, a 10-year indemnity. But we've put a cap on the amount that is owing for $150 million for pre-existing, so this is going back decades and decades, and then $30 million from 2014 to 2021. So now we know what that figure is. Does that mean we have to spend that? No. That's a situation. Hopefully this is going to be an operational refinery for some time. We're not going to need to worry about that. It's not like we need to remediate any day soon and prepare that land. That's hopefully not going to be an issue that we had to deal with. But it's certainly a number that's quantified now. It's far lower than what it possibly could have been. And not only that, the more money that the companies operating make, the amount of that liability to government actually goes down. So we put on, a reverse escalator clause in some ways, where now the indemnity that we are on the hook for will actually decrease as these companies become profitable. So again, it's win-win for everybody. All of that we would have been on the hook for if this whole thing shut down. So not only would we not have the jobs, not have the income, not have the spin-off, we would have still been holding the bag on an indemnity, on a liability. Now we have a quantified liability and the jobs and all the positive that comes from that.
So how long will this, for want of a better word, refit take? I mean, you're taking a diesel and gas refinery and you're turning it into this renewable type of thing. How much needs to be done there and how much will this cleanup look like?
Well, so there's no cleanup actually happening. That's just the possibility. If this thing were to completely go idle, to completely shut down, you're looking at the possibility of. So this is just it's a liability that may be on the books, but it may not be triggered. The goal is that obviously if this continues to operate as a refinery of some sort, that's not going to be an issue we deal with. The second part of that is they're hoping, their projections show mid-2022, and certainly I'm the last one to try to explain the complexities of the technical details of what they need to do to convert from the current refinery to what they want to get to. The reality is they've had actually about 400 people working right now trying to get it to that space. So I can't tell you what's going to happen, but what I can tell you is that it's at their cost. We're not paying for that. That's on them. That's part of the capital investment that they are willing to make because they feel this will be a profitable venture down the road. They're saying mid-2022, so that'll be phase one where they start refining. They're hoping to make this, I'm hoping to get the number right, about 14,000 barrels per day, which is certainly far less than what they're refining at peak when it came to oil. But then again, the goal for phase two, and this is where they're working with the federal government for possible investment there through different federal means, especially as it goes to, you know, getting new biofuels and renewables. They hope for increased funding there from the federal government, not us. They'll see that amount of refining go from 14 to basically double or even beyond.
So how did this all come together? Because Kaushik Amin of Silver Peak, who appears to be a bit of a hoot, credited government with coming up with the idea.
Well, I certainly can't take any credit, and I will say that Kaushik's certainly an interesting gentleman, but he's very passionate about it. Like, there was never any doubting that. It was just about getting everybody to the same page as to what worked for them, but especially from our point of view, what worked for us as a province, what worked for our taxpayers. In this case, part of it, and again, we were always a facilitator. We never owned the asset, which we said many, many times. This is about him trying to find people to come in and partner with him or for him to sell to in order to, I guess, recoup his investment, or because he did make significant investments over the last 7 years. Part of that process, when we talked, was actually facilitating conversations with different federal entities like Investing Canada. I think in one of those conversations, that's where the possibility of the renewable diesel came from. I certainly can't take any credit for it. I'm not smart enough for that. And I didn't know, again, this is not my background in terms of knowing what the possibilities were. But once they saw that it could be done, once they saw that it's certainly something where the federal government has their head. We all know what their environmental bent is in terms of moving forward with clean fuel and everything like that. It became more real, and all credit to Kaushik and his team. They took it and ran with it.
What about that 5 cent a liter gas tax that's been
the bane of my existence?
The bane of your existence. Yeah, what about that? And why can't that be removed?
So I'm going to try to explain this because, you know, if there's one topic I've heard about, this is probably number one in over the last year in terms of people talking about the 5 cent. And don't get me wrong, I get it. I understand. But the reality is that, so back when the refinery stopped, they are responsible, North Atlantic is responsible for the importation of fuel, a safe and steady, secure supply of fuel, which meant they needed to start importing. They couldn't use any of the product there because they were no longer refining. Because of the increased cost, and I feel like I'm explaining here their side. If anything, they and the PUB should be explaining this because it's not our decision. Because they had increased cost, went to the PUB, who regulate the rates on gasoline, on fuels, and said, our costs are up. Here's the evidence behind this. We would like an increase. In fact, the 5 cents is possibly lower than what they asked for. The Public Utilities Board, which is the independent regulator, they looked at it. They saw they granted the 5 cents. The problem being with this deal, and believe me, going through all this, I saw this all in advance. I said, even with this great news, I said, the top question you're going to get is the 5 cents. And so certainly now with this deal, they're continuing to not refine oil here. That cost stays in place. They are still paying for that. Therefore, the 5 cents stays there. And it's absolutely frustrating. A couple pointers I would make is, number one, I think it's up to the Public Utilities Board, and I emphasize the word public, because I feel it's their duty. Again, I cannot instruct them what to do. I cannot tell them how to do their job. But we are looking at a review of the PUB, especially as they deal with electricity rates as well. But I do feel as a funded entity, as a group that we're responsible for, and that taxpayers have to look at the repercussions of their decisions, I do feel that they should be out trying to help explain this to citizens of this province about why they've done that. I also wonder as to why When is it triggered that there's a review? What has to happen to cause a review of this? And there's certainly nothing against North Atlantic or importer or any importer of fuel. There's nothing against anybody. It's just asking the questions that I get asked all the time, which is, what will ever cause that to go away? So again, I put that to the PUB. In fact, I wrote to them some time ago with questions like that. And so, not to be confused, I didn't direct them to do anything or ask them to do anything. I just said, can you please explain this? Now, I haven't heard back yet, which is unfortunate. But again, I put it out there that I do feel there's a mandate to explain to the general public as to what's going on here and why is it going on.
Will we still be able to call Come By Chance a refinery?
Absolutely. I know that they've rebranded now to Brea Renewable Fuels. But if I were a betting person, I would suggest that that's always going to be referred to as Come By Chance.
My guest today on Target is the Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology, Andrew Parsons. We'll be back right after this.
The Workday winds down with Greg Smith in the Drive. Get up to speed on the day's events and current traffic, weather, and community updates each weekday afternoon on your VOCM.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My guest today is the Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology, Andrew Parsons. And Andrew, I'm going to ask about the energy section of your big, vast portfolio. Come By Chance, of course, the announcement last week is about renewables. And having seen, of course, some of the devastation caused by changes in the climate, how do you square non-renewable resource development with, the urgency that many people feel is needed to reduce carbon emissions?
It's an excellent question, and one that certainly is always top of mind, and especially, you know, when you have events that happen now where people are putting that together. And I think the good news is that I think we're getting past the hurdle of, you know, the questioning of it. I can't imagine there's anybody rational or reasonable that's doubting it now. The situation we find ourselves, though, is that it's a transition. And so I don't think there's anything happening where all of a sudden it's going to be a full stop and then turn on a dime. The reality is that it has taken us a significant period of time to get to this point. We're going to need to change. We're going to need to turn that around and transition. It's not going to be as long, but it's certainly not going to be immediate. The reality is that, you know, I don't think the planes have changed over yet to be electrified. That's one of the things we're dealing with. We know that there's popularization now of EVs, which is great, which we're supporting. But we still live in a world that relies on this commodity. And one of the things that I say to myself is that, okay, if we pull ourselves out of this market, our position will be taken over extremely quickly by other countries, whether that be Russia, whether that be the Saudis, whether that be Brazil, whether that be Guyana. So why would we go ahead and do that and basically punish ourselves and allow somebody else to take that, especially when the fact that when you look at a project like Bay du Nord, the reality is that resource is far, and again, I get the oxymoron in calling any of this clean, but that resource is far cleaner than that same resource in other jurisdictions. We've been saying to the world, we've been saying to the federal government that we want to be a part of that clean transition that's happening. And you see, one of the big changes that you're seeing too, and it started, I would suggest, with Equinor, formerly Statoil, a few years ago. They have changed the way that they operate globally in the sense that they recognize what they have to do. They've changed their mandate now to keep these things in mind in terms of projects that they're developing. You're seeing other changes, whether it comes to, like, just looking at NOIA, who, again, is the advocacy group for, you know, the offshore industry in this province, well known. A couple things. Number one, they're looking at the fact that a lot of their membership, yes, they have done very well with oil and gas, and they're going to continue to do well. But they also realize that they need and want to pivot as well, that you can have different streams. So they're looking at, you know, how do they rebrand or change what they're doing. The second thing is that, you know, we've announced some funding recently when it came to just part of that federal funding we got last year, $320 million, which funded a whole range of different projects, research, a lot of it looking at different things that we need to do going forward, whether it is, you know, digitization, whether it's electrification, whether it's looking at other possibilities. One of the things that we did fund was a project between NOIA and Econext two groups that, you know, just a couple of years ago you would have said were diametrically opposed, and now they're collaborating, working together. I think that shows you the shift that is happening in this province. So people realize where we need to go, but I also think we need to be responsible about it, and that is not going to happen overnight.
Now, we're a little bit reduced because we went long with the Port of Bass section, so we're going to go into another commercial break, but I want to talk to you about mining and technology in the next segment when we come back. My guest today is the Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology, Andrew Parsons. We'll be back right after this.
The workday winds down with Greg Smith in the Drive. Get up to speed on the day's events and current traffic, weather and community updates each weekday afternoon on your VOCM.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is the Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology, Andrew Parsons, and we're going to touch on a couple of other his other portfolio or segments of his portfolio. Industry, mining, what's happening with resource development in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Well, it's, I tell you, when it comes to mining, it's absolutely booming right now. It's just amazing to see what's going on. Just today alone, I've had a number of meetings with different operators and outfits that are looking to be here. And it's not just in one field. I mean, the first one that a lot of people see is just gold and how we're literally in a modern-day gold rush here, especially in Central. But you're seeing it in different parts. In fact, I see it in my own district in the Southwest Coast. Matador Mining is there, and they're showing some promising numbers. I mean, that stands to benefit the entire province, not just those that work here, but again, between the spin-offs, the income that comes into the province, the taxation side, it's just a really positive thing. Then you look at, again, the workhorse, which is Labrador. I mean, they've been the backbone of the industry. You know, IOC, Vale, I mean, what's going on in Labrador, again, has been there and has certainly been steady, even during the pandemic. A lot of change now when you see what's, you know, rare earth minerals, when you see the different critical minerals that we have here in our province, which are going to form a part of where the economy and where our future needs to be. So we're really well placed. Thankfully, you know, we've got a great group here, both within the department, but certainly, you know, whether it's mining and L, whether it's our prospectors. If anything, the biggest challenge that we face there is trying to find people, trying to find the equipment so that more can be done.
Now, you mentioned a few of these letters that you've been writing lately. I know one of the letters that you wrote was to Elon Musk. Is that right?
That was actually, I never wrote to Mr. Musk. That last year there was just, again, I see that he's fairly active on Twitter. So for a lark, we said, well, why don't we just send the tweet out there and see where it goes? And certainly it got a fair bit of attention. So it hasn't transpired in anything yet, but, you know, it was 140 characters, so it didn't really cost us much.
So did you get any response, or are you hopeful that he's noticed us in any way?
You know, I'm sure. Put it this way, I have no doubt that when it comes to Tesla, that there could be a future there. I mean, they are certainly a visionary, future-driven company. But whether he's noticing us, I think he's perhaps a little too invested in space travel right now. But who knows? Again, if there's opportunity, his company's there. But like I say, part of what we do, in fact, you know, on a serious side, part of what the different industries tell us is, look, you need to promote Newfoundland and Labrador. So if sending a little tweet out there can generate one more group, one more capital investor that wants to look at this jurisdiction and say, hey, that place looks really interesting, then the job is done.
Indeed, because he's not the only one, I would imagine, looking for what he's looking for.
We are absolutely on the map worldwide, absolutely. When it comes to mining now, we've done our part. Certainly, we've participated in international venues. And again, it's been difficult because, you know, we've only been able to operate virtually. But hopefully, as things move, you know, move forward, as vaccination gets higher, as we get through this, I think we can continue to do our job to promote ourselves out there.
And, of course, he's very involved in technology, and that's part of your portfolio as well. And there's been a lot of interesting and exciting developments in the realm of technology over the last year, and I know you really, really like to talk about it.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. It's probably been one of the – again, they're all really exciting. But when I go and visit these companies and the ideas that they're putting out there, which are world-class – and, look, it's not where my – brain goes. It's not where my skill set lies. So when I see these people, I'm like, not only did you come up with this fantastic idea, but had the ability to to take it and then to make it practical and to generate an app, to generate processes, and then to generate money. It's huge. And to see these people when they say, you know what, we could be here or we could be in, you know, Silicon Valley, we could be in New York, we could be in Chicago, we could be in Toronto. But nope, we want to be here in Newfoundland and Labrador. That's where we're from. That's where we want to hire people and keep it here. And again, Verafin is almost like the godfather of it now. But I got to tell you, there's a lot of companies coming up behind them, using them as the model. And the Verafin team are the first ones to take what they've done and share it with everyone else. The atmosphere within the community is contagious. Everybody sees a win as a win for them all. And I see it as a win for our province. So, again, it's not just me. I've got a lot of colleagues that are really on board with it. Tom Osborne with Education was just at Computer Science Week. Jerry Byrne with Immigration, realizing we need a bigger workforce. The Premier himself has absolutely been behind it all and really promoting it. So I get excited. I could go on all day about it. I do think it's has the potential to be the next oil and gas for Newfoundland and Labrador.
Not only does it have the ability to generate money, but it has the ability to generate big money, as you just referenced with the Verafin sale. And it has impacts on all aspects of our lives, because I had the Real Estate Association on last week and I asked them about some trends. And they said, well, we saw this huge uptake in high-end home sales. And I said, what spurred that? And he said, Verafin.
Absolutely. And I mean, so you get that side of it, which is huge. But when you see what these people and these ideas are able to do, they're able to take traditional industries and to make them better. And you know, and technology sort of permeates everything in our shop. I mean, mining is trying to get better. They're trying to find new, more efficient ways to deliver their product. When you look at oil and gas, we're talking about digitization and doing different things, trying to be able to operate remotely, all these things. When you look at just, you know, moving into the newer renewable forms of energy, which is going to be huge. We're going to be announcing something on that very, very soon. Technology underpins all of it. And again, it goes into health. I'm having such interesting meetings on what tech can do, and not only how it can make our healthcare system better, our education system better, but how it can generate money for our province, how it can generate revenue, jobs. Like, there's so much potential. So it's absolutely interesting, but like anything, everybody's competing. So I feel like sometimes like we're on fire here, because we need to compete with every other province who want the same thing, with every other jurisdiction. So we've got a lot of intrinsic benefits here, benefits that only we in Newfoundland and Labrador have what we can offer. Now we've got to find a way to show it to the world and get those people here.
Yeah, you hinted at it just then. You said you got a big announcement coming in not too far distant future, but we're heading into a new calendar year. What's on tap? We've got a minute and a half.
Okay, well, we're going to be announcing, hopefully very soon, our renewable energy plan to guide us going into the future. So hopefully that will lay the groundwork for where we envision ourselves. Obviously, we would like to see some big announcements in 2022 as it relates to the oil industry. I'd like to see a lot more in terms of tech and like venture capital. We're putting money out there. We're making investments. Hopefully, we continue to see the returns that we have. Hopefully, we're going to see increased jobs. I want to see immigration increase here, which then leads to jobs being created. Mining has just been a banner year. The question becomes, can it be even better, which is hard to imagine, but I think I can imagine just about anything right now. That's how positive everything in this department is.
It sounds like you're loving it.
You know what? I really enjoy it. I'm very blessed that I have a great team around me who I love to work with, and the industry, all the different industries, are exciting. They're excited to be here. They want, like, if anything, is we don't have enough time. And you know what? That's a good way to work when you feel that you've got to speed everything up. I don't mind that one bit.
And we don't have enough time, unfortunately. We could go on and on, I know. Andrew Parsons, thank you for being so accessible. Really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll be back tomorrow. A topic near and dear to my heart. Just wait for it.